Hello and welcome once again to the Waterstones podcast. I'm Will Rycroft and I am both very, very excited and also ever so slightly intimidated by the fantastic authors that I've been able to assemble for this episode. All authors, of course, you could even say, I suppose, all artists are responding to the world when they create a piece of art or a book. But these three authors, as you will hear, I think are responding to something very specifically in this moment that we're all kind of going through at the moment, and in some cases sort of looking forward into the future, which I find fascinating. And so I can't wait to speak to them all. First of all, Gary Steingart's latest novel, Our Country Friends, was written in direct response to the pandemic and the experience of lockdown in particular. And he assembles a cast of motley characters, isolates them in a country estate, and has created a brilliant novel, which is about friendships and changing relationships and shifting priorities in the face of cultural changes around us. So welcome, first of all, to Gary.
Hi, good to be here.
Sakoya Nagamatsu spent 10 years developing his debut novel, How High We Go in the Dark, but had the prescience to publish this tale of humanity recovering from a global plague caused by climate change, just as we all emerged blinking into 2022. Grief, loneliness and human connection all loom large in this genre-bending book, which manages to zoom out in one of the most audacious ways. So welcome, Sakoya.
Thanks for having me, Will.
And finally, we are joined by Jennifer Egan, who won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 2011 for her novel A Visit from the Goon Squad, which showed a huge cast of characters adapting to the digital age, and it contained the only great narrative as PowerPoint presentation ever published. Her new novel, The Candy House, continues the stories for some of those characters and also introduces us to some new ones and showcases once again her ability to write about technology's impact on humanity in a way that no other writer seems to be able to do. So welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you.
So where to begin with these three very different books? Gary, I'm going to start with you first of all, because you wrote Our Country Friends clearly in direct response to the pandemic and lockdown. I think it was probably quite quickly during lockdown that some wag on Twitter I saw said that the thing that they were most scared about was the thing that was bound to happen in about 6 to 9 months' time, which was that there'd be a raft of pandemic novels appearing. So I just wonder whether you were ever worried at any point about writing about something so directly that we were all going through.
Well, usually I write about crappy futures, so for me to write about the crappy present was a little bit of a change of pace. When I was actually working on a dystopian novel right before the pandemic happened, and it was, it's a little bit New York specific. It was a novel in which NYU, New York University, had taken over Manhattan and had built walls around it. And, you know, they had their own peacekeeping troops and stuff like that. I think if you know how NYU works, if you live downtown like I do, it has a specific kind of importance to you. But I would say that it was like a funny novel. It was based, you know, like a satire of academia. But as the pandemic started, the moment it started, I thought, oh boy, you know, this is a lot more tragic than even NYU taking over Manhattan, as tragic as that would be. So I began to, as the young tech people would say, I began to pivot. And I was at that point living in upstate New York, which is where Our Country Friends takes place. And I fell into this very kind of different mood from my usual sort of antic urban escapades. There was no one to drink with, first of all. So, you know, I found myself with a lot of time in my hands, a lot of sober time. And I used that sober time to walk around the countryside, to take it in. You know, I got all these apps that you could point to flowers and trees and birds that told me what they were. You know, it's like, oh, it's an oak. Okay. You know. So I really got into nature. At the same time, I was rereading Chekhov, a lot of his best, well, not just plays, but short stories. Trying to think of the English translate, About Love, Man in a Shell, Gooseberries, a lot of those really great short stories all take place in the countryside. And it's always a group of friends. They've gathered around, they're middle-aged, and they're like, oh, what a waste our life has been. We didn't find the the person we loved never returned our love. We didn't settle in the right career. Everything's terrible. And I thought, well, I can do that with my own friends, you know. And so I kind of put them all in, created some, you know, I smashed a bunch of friends into, like, four friends would go into making one fictional friend. And then I just kind of set them loose upon each other, and you know, hijinks ensued. And before I knew it, 6 months, I'm sure Sequoia and Jennifer will agree, it takes a lot longer. Well, Sequoia, you were saying 10 years it took you to write this, right? Usually it takes me forever too. But again, because of the lack of alcohol and people to drink it with, this thing came out in 6 months, you know, so the pandemic was very good to me. Yeah.
I was going to ask whether you felt sort of obviously a pressure to get it done quickly so that it would remain relevant, but you found that you were actually energized by what was happening. It wasn't so much of an effort to get it done.
I was energized, but you know, it's interesting because I'm sorry, I didn't really answer your original question, but you know, I sent a few chapters to my US editor and he was like, yeah, go for it. I love this. I even gave him like a Hollywood tagline. I'm like, it's Chekhov meets the Big Chill. And he was like, yeah, I think we can sell that. But my old British publisher was actually like, I don't think anyone in their right mind is going to want to read about, you know, the pandemic. And so I actually switched publishers in the UK. So that was interesting because I think the first reaction, I don't fault him. I think it makes sense. He was like, I don't know. But, you know, but the final book is, I think, hopefully as funny as anything I've ever written. It's just, you know, it's just me, but sober and in a pandemic. I don't know if I'm selling it, but yeah.
Hey, the taglines just keep coming. I think that I probably wasn't thinking I wanted to read a book about the pandemic, especially whilst I suppose we were still kind of in it. But I was surprised by how much I loved this book. Wow. I'm a big fan of Chekhov, like yourself, and recognize those influences. But they're added together with the humor that I think a lot of your readers will know to expect from you. There is this reflective quality, and there is this melancholy, actually, yeah, as you say, which feels very Russian.
Yeah, and also, you know, I mean, the pandemic was tragic, but it was also in some horrible ways really comic. And I think nobody understands that better than a UK audience.
So, Kara, I'll come to you next because, as we said earlier, you had been working on your novel for a long time, and sometimes the stars align and, mm-hmm, you know, a book has a huge relevance. It feels that your book would have always been relevant because it does look at climate change initially. But for those who haven't read it yet, what happens is that because of climate change melting the permafrost and a young girl's body is found from many thousands of years ago, and it contains a virus which spreads across the world and causes a plague. And it's about how humanity reacts to that. How did you feel, I suppose, as you approached publication to see what was happening in the real world? That must have been conflicting.
Well, I think, I suppose, you know, I've been working on this for 10 years, but I would say I only regarded it as a novel, as How High We Go in the Dark, for maybe 3 or 4 of those years. And of course, I procrastinated in the interim by writing a story collection before that, and life and trying to get a job in academia. And I never really, I think, saw this work as a plague novel for the longest time. And in fact, the plague element didn't enter into the project until about 2014. It was largely an exploration of different ways that people grieve and how we hold on to hope. And in some ways, you know, that's kind of the takeaway that I want readers to walk away with. When the pandemic hit, however, I definitely started looking at the novel with a new lens about how other people might sort of look at the book. And, you know, when you're working with an agent, especially on edits, you're kind of hoping that the next email or the next call is your agent telling you, I think we're ready. Well, let's go out with it. And it just so happened that my agent gave me that call in 2020, in the spring of 2020, in the early days of COVID. And instead of being ecstatic that I was finally going to go out with basically what has been, you know, a project of many years, I was horrified. I was, I think, very despondent and anxious about how editors would respond to it. And I think, you know, sort of Gary sort of spoke to this a little bit. that some editors just might run away in the opposite direction. And I think some editors might have had that reaction, but we were very careful about our talking points when we approached the industry to make sure that editors realized that this wasn't Outbreak. If this wasn't Dustin Hoffman and Cuba Gooding Jr. jumping out of a helicopter, it wasn't that. I was never writing that novel. And I'm not entirely sure what people mean by pandemic fiction, because oftentimes it's not that. It's something that's very humanistic. We were very lucky to find the right partners at William Morrow and at Bloomsbury, because they immediately saw the project as a book that was exploring more than just the moment, more than just the pandemic. Because once the virus is introduced, it really kind of falls to the background, and we're following individual lives as they're reacting in small ways and trying to connect to each other or reconcile memory or figure out how to pay an homage to a life that they'll never get back again. And I think as the pandemic progressed, I realized that, my earlier anxieties, maybe while partly founded, began to be replaced by, I think this book can actually be in conversation with what people are going through. Not only because all of my characters are Asian American or Asian, in a time when there was a lot of anti-Asian hatred and incidents going on around the world, but also because the big question of the book is, how do we, look at a tragedy as a kind of space to reimagine ourselves and our lives and our future? And I think that's a question that a lot of people have been asking. I mean, people have been quitting their jobs in record numbers. People have been taking on a weird little house. I have a hydroponic garden in my office here. So I felt that this book could sort of nod at some of those questions and explorations that we've been engaging with recently. That said, I think, since the book has come out, I realize that people are responding differently, and as they should. People react differently to a trauma like this. People grieve differently. And so I know that some people aren't ready for a book like this, while many other readers might actually find catharsis by looking at a pandemic that's far shittier than our own. And also, thinking about how the different ways people are grieving, whether that's through technology or through otherworldly means, can actually make, help them come to a place where they might figure out how they can move on themselves, whether that's, reimagining their life, saying goodbye to loved ones, or just how do we emerge out of 2 years of stasis, of just not leaving our house physically, mentally.
You mentioned how it sort of came out of your, working on it a long time and not thinking about it as a novel. And I suppose that in some ways, when you read the novel, it does have these almost story-like qualities, mm-hmm. these sort of separate stories, separate moments. But there's also something about, I'm going to call it the audacity of your novel, because, mm-hmm. and I wonder whether the confidence to write those things comes from your story writing, where you would present something in a much shorter form. Because you look at grief, but you do it in really extraordinary ways and show how people react to it, so that we, the reader, see these funerary hotels. And the thing I think I'll never quite recover from, as somebody who likes to go to theme parks, what theme parks where people are going to be euthanized, which is, I'm going to have to explain this to my children the next time I take them to a theme park. It's got a very different tone for me now, but did the confidence to sort of put some of these things in your book come from, is it sort of a genre-based thing? Would you consider this to be science fiction, or is it to do with having that sort of confidence of writing the shorter form and just presenting the reader with something that they're not expecting?
I mean, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I think if I sat down to write a novel that had all of these things in it, I probably would approach it differently, or wouldn't do it at all. I think part of the audacity, was a result of it coming to me in a very sort of piecemeal, kaleidoscopic fashion. And, as I said before, I think for half of the book's life, it was kind of just individual pieces. And eventually I started to see connections. And once I started to see the connections, I had to figure out how do I puzzle this together? What's the frame? What's the through line? What are the Easter eggs that I'm going to plant along the way? And, you know, at that point, you know, I was having a lot of conversations with my agent about, well, what do we call this now? Like, nobody knows what a novel and stories is. I guess we just call it a novel, right? And then some people will call you out. It's like, well, is this a novel? Well, I ultimately think it is, you know? And so I started, you know, revisiting a lot of my, you know, favorite books that were doing similar things. You know, I was revisiting, you know, Goon Squad. I was reading David Mitchell. And really, I think immersing myself in that kind of space. I guess the other part of it is that, you know, science fiction is such a messy label. Categories are messy. I often use the term speculative because readers at least seem to kind of use the definition of speculative as being literary sci-fi, and I kind of hate the term literary as well, but there it is. I guess apart from categories, you know, I'll just say I was a huge Star Trek nerd growing up, so I was always used to these large cosmic ideas, and I was always very comfortable engaging with these, you know, whether that be a technology, whether that be, you know, working with a very large kind of geologic timescales, that wasn't new to me for this project. So I was relatively comfortable there.
And you mentioned the scale that you're working on. You do this thing towards the end of the book, which is to almost zoom out in a way that provides a whole new perspective on mm-hmm. things. It's almost a bit like that bit. Is it the end of the first Men in Black movie where it sort of zooms out and out mm-hmm. and out and you realize that the universe is just a marble, you know? And mm-hmm. it sort of has that feeling to it. And for me, that gave partly this book the note of hope that you mentioned earlier mm-hmm. that was obviously so required. Is that what you were sort of aiming for with that time perspective?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I also just kind of wanted to nod at our humanity sort of through non-human lenses as well. And in some ways, I think that sort of emphasizes the humanity kind of to look at it through a different perspective or look at it askance or askew in some way. But zooming out in that fashion, I think also allows readers to read the book in different ways, should they choose. It's kind of a book that demands that it be read twice. Mm. And depending on how you read it, you know, I've seen certain reviews where the ending makes a lot of sense and it's kind of like, oh my God, I can't believe how everything wrapped up together, or like, I don't understand how this ending has to do with anything, depending on if you're actually picking up on the clues along the way. Mm-hmm. But I think it is a book that can be read multiple ways.
You mentioned Goon Squad, so I'm going to turn to Jennifer now, because despite these three books being so very, very different, they do have connections, of course, and one of those is connection, but we'll come to that later. But Jennifer, when I read Goon Squad, there were so many things that I loved about it, but I do remember one of the things was the way that you spoke a little bit about the near future, which is always a risky thing for any novelist to do, because the worry is that you'll get it wrong or that it'll immediately date or whatever it might be. And I remember you mentioning people looking at their handhelds, I think is how you refer to them. And every time now I walk down the street and I see the way in which people are now learning, it seems almost like an evolutionary step to walk down the street with only their peripheral vision because they are staring at their phones. I think of your book because I'm like, Jennifer got it absolutely right. Look, this is exactly what she said would happen. And again, now with The Candy House, you have dared to sort of talk about technology again. When you sit down to write about it, do you ever worry about sort of getting it wrong, or do you just trust your instinct and think this is the thing that's the key here and therefore it will definitely be right?
You know, kind of neither, because I don't really start out thinking about technology per se. I mean, the only reason I ever ended up writing about the future in Goon Squad, and that future was actually like exactly our present, was that I wanted to follow certain characters into a later point in their lives. And because of the structure of you know, the time structure I had created, there was absolutely no way to do that without going into the future. And I so much didn't want to do it in Goon Squad that I toyed with the idea of moving the entire timetable backward, but that took me back to like Elvis, you know, a whole kind of musical era that wasn't part of my life and that I had no relationship to. So that was impossible. So I kind of, you know, drifted into the future very unwillingly, maybe because of what you say, not wanting to get things wrong. But I'm so non-technological as a citizen, as a kind of consumer, so uninterested in technology per se, that I don't ever approach it as an expert or even someone trying to predict the future. My goals are really always literary. You know, what am I trying to do? And I agree with Sequoia. I don't love that word or categories generally, but you know, I'm just trying to figure out how to make it good, how to get done what I want to get done in the text. And usually the technology comes along because it helps me do that. So, you know, I now that I've in the Candy House ended up in the 2030s, again, completely driven by my wish to follow certain characters into their futures, I've sort of embraced the fact that it gives me a lot of freedom to just make up whatever the hell I want that gets the job done that I'm trying to do. And because I'm not really engaging in a very specific way with the world of technology as we know it, I guess I hope that I'm a little bit inoculated against getting it wrong because I'm not really trying to get it right. I mean, luckily I'm not putting a product on the market because God only knows whether, you know, I'm sure I'd be terrible at that. I'm just trying to write a book that is fun. And so I have found that if I don't, you know, that if I use imagined technology properly, and opportunistically, it can help me do that job.
The technology you've imagined in the Candy House is probably best explained by you, but I will try. Own Your Unconscious is the technology, and it is a means by which people can essentially download their unconscious memories so that they can see with the same clarity as we would on the TV what's actually happened in their with their memories in their lives, and that they can then choose to share those to the cloud, as you will, and with other people's memories, and therefore you can then access what else is there, which seems to me to be a rather brilliant metaphor for just the internet that we all know and love and how much of ourselves we're willing to give up in order to have access to what we want. It's an audacious idea, but it's quite brilliant and also terrifying. So you mentioned there about the idea of you bringing a product to market. How would you actually feel about something like Own Your Unconscious existing in the real world?
Well, you know, I would only engage with any kind of technology if I felt like it was alluring enough to be sort of appealing in a certain way. In other words, I'm never interested in just a kind of you know, a work of fiction that's full of dread and warnings. I was interested in what the allure of this product would be. And in a way, I arrived at it as much through a kind of wish fulfillment of my own as anything else. So for example, I found myself thinking, wouldn't it be cool if, you know, we could actually do facial recognition on a person we had seen just once many years ago and just find out what's happened to them. Or another thought was, you know, if you know, wouldn't it be great as an adult to look back on certain childhood memories and see what I think about them and sort of what really happened there? So, and then another thought was, wouldn't it be great if just in the way that young women sometimes now freeze their eggs so that they can make sure that they're able to have children at a later point, what if we could sort of freeze our consciousnesses, as it were, or our memories, so that if, for example, you know, I have a lot of Alzheimer's and dementia in my family, if that started to happen, what if I could just reinfuse that healthy consciousness and be fine? So those are obviously very appealing notions. You know, there are some much less appealing aspects of it, which I think we find with using technology all the time. I mean, it's wonderful to have access, but it didn't occur to a lot of us for a long time that even though that access seemed to be free, it was because we were in an economy that was working differently. And what we were and are paying with is actually our attention and our personal information. So I guess I just wanted to sort of get into that kind of transaction and and follow all of its ramifications in people's lives in ways that seemed appealing and fun.
One of the most striking things about your works is you mentioned there that all you're really caring about is the writing, and the form that your writing takes can often be quite extraordinary. So I mentioned the PowerPoint presentation in Goon Squad, which I mention it because it's genius as far as I'm concerned. And the reason why it works is because it is the perfect way to represent that chapter. Rather than it feeling like a sort of form imposed because it's an idea. You kind of go, oh, I wonder if you can write a chapter as a PowerPoint presentation. And then in Candy House, there are some other chapters which are presented very stylistically. Do you find those forms through experimentation and trying to realize the best way of communicating a particular feeling or character or story? Or do you try out various things first and find the one that works best?
You know, I often have kind of a list of things I would love to try to use to write fiction. PowerPoint was on that list well before I managed to figure out how to do it. Twitter went onto that list. And in fact, the chapter that was tweeted from the Candy House back in 2012, I actually started working on that while on my book tour for A Visit from the Goon Squad. So I was sort of imagining beyond it right away. So I kind of have this list of things I'd love to try, but as you say, and this is really something I found, there's no way to just graft some kind of cool structural idea onto a story that could be told conventionally or in a different way, because that conventional is another label I don't really like and don't think it's very helpful. The bottom line is, it's when I have a list of structures I'd like to try and I'm hoping I can use them, what I'm really doing is waiting to find some story, some narrative that can only live in that structure. And that's the only way it will work. And there's a lot of trial and error along the way. There are things I want to try that I've still not been able to make work. But the payoff for me is that if I can make it work, and the PowerPoint is a good example, not that everyone thinks that worked, by the way, but if I can make it work, at least to my satisfaction, I am telling a story I could not have otherwise told, because it wouldn't work if that weren't the case. And so what these structures offer to me is just the chance to keep growing. And that's why I'm really drawn to them.
It's really interesting, as I said, that these books that seem very different do have these connections, and that actually all of the books mention technology in some way. Gary, I'll come back to you, because even though what we've described would seem to be a sort of comedy of manners in a country estate, the technology plays a very large part in it. There is an app that one of your characters has created which seems to make people fall in love with each other, and then there is the whole specter of social media access and how it shapes people's personalities, particularly a young daughter. What this sort of brings to mind is this idea of human connection. Because we often think of technology as being this thing that's supposed to help us communicate with others, but actually what it does is ruin the communication between human beings. And it's only when your characters are forced to spend time together at that country estate that they really do connect on a human level. Tell me a little bit more about your thoughts on technology and connection.
Yeah, I mean, when I first moved upstate, one of the big, which is about 100 miles north of New York, one of the selling points of it was that there was very little connectivity. It's hard to connect. So again, I was able to do a lot more work because there just wasn't enough internet to go around. You have to position yourself in a weird way to catch the internet. It was a fleeing thing. Sometimes it'd come on, sometimes it'd go off. One of the conceits of the book is that there's only one part of the house that the eight characters who are sort of marooned together, Gilligan's Island style, can find any kind of connectivity. So a lot of the times they actually have to talk to one another, which is, you know, difficult these days, but that's what they do. They have to actually communicate. And then I created True Emotions. That's the name of the app, True Emotions, that makes people fall in love with one another. And I think partly it was just a great sort of, for me, a plot device, because, you know, if you have, it's almost like, you know, Midsummer's Night Dream or something, you have a love potion. How am I going to do a love potion? Because I wanted this character to fall in love with another character that normally would never happen in real life, because he's this world famous actor. And she's just a middling essayist. And in real life, that probably wouldn't work. But with this app, he falls in love, and there's no way he can get out of it. And he spends most of the novel trying to get out of being in love with her. And so that was really just a great way to advance the plot for me. But also, I realized that, you know, people these days, young people, I teach creative writing at Columbia University, so I do see a lot of young people. And I realized that all of their connectivity is with all of their romantic engagements begin with looking at a screen. And, you know, and there is an algorithm that tells you who you should be in love with in a way. You know, if you're into, I don't know, I was going to say roller skating, but that's probably not what people do these days. I don't know. I'm so out of it. I don't know. What do people do? If you're into horse riding, no, that's not it either. But whatever it is, see, I'm showing you how exactly. If you're into drinking, okay, that's something I can identify with. Then you'll have all these shots of somebody with a martini in their hand. If you follow me on Instagram, that's all I do, right? So if you're looking for a partner, that person will come up first. So already the technology is telling you, oh, I think I know you, and I think I'm going to tell you who you should be with. And in the book, the technology is sort of just that, but refined to the nth degree. And the other part of it is that I enjoyed was someone gets canceled in this book, which I had so much fun with. Because I do love Twitter, and I do love watching people get canceled. Often they're my friends. And it's so much fun. I mean, I know. And they're okay. You know, they bounce back. You know, they're canceled 1 month, then they write a book about being canceled. And then they're on the bestseller list for a year. So I think it's good. You know, I think a little cancellation goes a long way. But also one of my characters is constantly trying to position herself for maximum exposure on social media, on Twitter to be precise. So she's of the left, but she's always like flirting with the far right just so people be like, oh, wow, you can never guess what she's going to say next. But then she ultimately gets into terrible trouble and brings the whole world around her crashing down, including the lives of the 8 people around her in the book. So I had a lot of fun with that, like just plotting out. I almost tried to get canceled, but it's very hard for me. I don't know why. I mean, if you're listening to this, just go on Twitter at Steingart and try to cancel me. I try. It would be so great for my sales.
Sequoia, obviously, The characters in your novel are often trying to maintain connection when they are separated by distance or by grief or by other things that are happening. And it is there is a craving for connection, I would sort of say. Was that one of the sort of main themes you were wanting to write about?
Yeah, you know, not only how we maintain relationships and find new connections, I think as Gary touched on, but how do we use technology, social media particularly, as a platform for grief and catharsis. And you know, my father passed away, you know, about a year and a half ago, and I was surprised, and maybe even not that surprised. One of the first things I did when I found out was I tweeted about it, and it was a needed part of my process. I needed that large virtual community to be with me in my grief and in helping me process. And it really helped me DMing sometimes with near perfect strangers as they told me about their experiences. And this is, I think, a phenomenon that, you know, if you told somebody, you know, 20, 30 years ago, that you would be sharing something that is, you know, really ultimately very private to thousands of people as part of the process of moving on, you know, it would seem like such a foreign concept, but it's really become, I think, relatively normalized. It's like the Facebook birthday, where you expect people to kind of like and say happy birthday to you, and you kind of know who doesn't, and then they're kind of on your shit list, you know, for a little while. But I felt like, you know, what would it be like to explore that kind of with regards to death? So there are different ways that my characters, I think, do this. There's, of course, the robotic dog who contains the only recorded voice, you know, these songs that this mother sang to her son. And this dog is ultimately going to fall into disrepair but this dog, and my robot dog is in the background, Calvino, is a bridge for father and son to connect. And it's not going to be a bridge that's permanent. And I think that's true for all of the chapters. The technology is there for the time that it needs to be. And once that technology has, presented its usefulness to the characters need to decide to reclaim their life and leave the house, put down the virtual reality helmet, and actually engage in a more tangible way. And I think that's something that, most of us, I think, recognize that we need to do more of. Where I've certainly thought that I've been keeping in touch with old friends through social media, and then a phone call or a dinner in their hometown or their home city really emphasizes the fact that we're no longer friends at all. That somewhere along the line that we've lost touch. And I'm hoping that, How High We Can Go in the Dark sort of at least addresses ways that we need to let go of that tendency, especially in times of healing.
It has been, as we emerged, as I said, into this year and therefore out of lockdown and back into sort of this sort of in real life interactions with people, it was, you can see how much people need them and enjoy them and how authentic they feel. And Jennifer, authenticity seems to me to be one of the key themes in, well, actually your writing in general, but in particular with Goon Squad and Candy House. Tell me a little bit more about authenticity, because it seems it ties in as well with your need to find the right means of communication with your own writing. It's about finding the right form for each chapter and therefore the authentic way to communicate.
Well, I'm sort of, from my first book, I've been really interested in mass media, sort of image culture, if you will, and how it functions in human life. And a book that really influenced my thinking a lot, but is a bit outdated now, although the theory underlying it is still very good, was written by Daniel Boorstin in 1961. It's called The Image. And he identifies a pattern or a phenomenon that I think holds very true through media culture to this moment. And that is that as experience feels mediated, we crave authenticity as a way out of that. But mass media and mediated experience also tries to satisfy that craving for authenticity through ever greater feats of mediation. And it really is true. I mean, if you look at, for example, reality TV, a very old phenomenon now, it's clearly, television trying to find a way to be sort of raw and real. And a lot of social media, it seems to me, is doing the same thing, looking for ways to give us the feeling of authentic experience and connection in a realm in which at least defining experience and connection in the old ways cannot actually satisfy that craving. And I guess one thing that's always fascinated me about media culture is that, and the kind of connection that we experience using it, is that it is both a presence and an absence. You know, when you connect with someone virtually, you are connecting with them. And I was so grateful for that during the pandemic, with elderly relatives, with people who were far away. It was much better than not connecting at all. And I found Zoom better than the phone. It was great to see people, but it is also, in a sense, a kind of testament to the fact that you are not in the same place. So there's kind of a paradox at the heart of online connection. And I don't have a judgment either way. I'm just fascinated by it.
We will, at the end of this episode, I'll be sharing a recording I managed to get with the writer Ali Smith, who, of course, is another writer who, over the last few years, has been responding to the world. She's written the seasonal quartet of books that were written and published in a very, very short time frame, so that when readers read them, it would be talking about the events that they were going through. And she happened to time this project for a period which has seen incredible upheaval and change with Brexit and Trump and all sorts of things happening in that period. And then having finished that quartet, her new book, Companion Piece, continues some of these thoughts and ideas. And so at the end of this podcast, you'll hear a companion piece audio from her where she talks about some of the stuff in there. But we have all, it feels, learnt something from the last couple of years. And in fact, in many ways, it's been a way of kicking forward progress. So, for example, the idea of, I mean, here I am working from home, which wouldn't have been considered possible a couple of years ago. But now so many more people are doing that, and it seems to be much more accepted. I wonder if I could ask each of you in turn what you have learnt over the last couple of years that has changed your perspective on life. Gary, I'll come to you first of all.
Well, off of what everyone has been saying about connection, I just want to say that during the pandemic, a lot of my friends who have been single forever actually broke down and decided to enter relationships. and I find that really cool. Like they couldn't do it anymore. I mean, they don't like other people, but they realize that loneliness was even worse than other people. And that's something that I really admire in them. But the other thing I realized, you know, when people talk about the pandemic novel, et cetera, and some of us are saying, well, that's maybe we shouldn't have these tags, you know, these categories, et cetera. But I think the crisis, the novel that deals with crisis is the novel that's going to be, it's going to be any novel dealing with what we used to call social realism, you know, writing about what's happening around us. Every novel is going to be a crisis novel because the crises that we're, and sorry, I don't want to be a downer, but the crises that we're now facing are going to be all over the map. You know, the pandemic is one thing, but it belies a gigantic ecological collapse that the world is facing. In our country, friends, there is an 8-year-old girl, and, you know, one of the characters calls her Generation L, as in Generation Last. There's a lot of, which is haha funny there, but, you know, there's all the books that we're going to be reading, it's almost like books that were written between 39 and 45 and set during that time. I mean, they could be tiny stories about a little family or a love affair, but they were taking place in a tiny village somewhere that may not be directly affected by the war, but the war was always in the background. There's no way that you could live through those events and write about them without thinking about what was happening in the background. And so I think that in this century, unless we figure things out, and I hope we do, but I don't think we will, fiction will be addressing all of these things. That's what I learned from not just the pandemic, but the, you know, I grew up in Russia and live in America. And now, you know, America was in a state of collapse for a while, maybe still is. And Russia collapsed almost completely at this point. So when I look at the world, I think that fiction, if we're going to write either about the future or about the present, and I'm not even sure what the difference is between those two anymore, we're going to have to focus on not just the foreground that we want to show, which will be the traditional stories. Nothing ever changes. People have children or they fall in love or they have siblings or they have friends and there's all kinds of interpersonal stuff. But the background is going to be this new world that we live in. And I think it would be doing it, unless you want to do a historical novel, it would be doing reality, you would be giving reality short shrift if we don't both show the same things that always happen between human beings, the interactions that we love, but also the state of decay that's behind us. Mm.
Sequoia, I can see you nodding your head there. You obviously agree. I wonder how you feel about sort of, you mentioned there about speculative fiction. Does the present feel more speculative than ever before?
Yeah, we're living in, you know, in a dystopian novel, in a science fictional novel. I think, you know, the gap has really sort of diminished between, you know, the future and the present. And, you know, I teach a climate fiction class and have for a few years. And when we're talking about climate change and environmental, you know, conservation and activism, oftentimes we're so focused on solutions and technologies and policy, and all of those things are certainly important. But oftentimes what gets left off the table is a focus on community and a capacity for empathy. And if I've learned anything over the past couple of years is that there have been some wonderful examples of community and empathy, but it's also been a very instructive time and be a very disheartening time where I've realized we have a long way to go with regards to empathy in order for us to actually act in a way that we need to address something like the climate crisis. You know, so in a lot of ways, the pandemic is a climate narrative. I think beyond that, I think on a more personal note, what I've learned, you know, from this period is simply to say no. It's to say no to things that don't bring me joy, and to say no to things that are, you know, toxic in any way for my life. And sometimes, you know, that's unavoidable. You know, that's life. But I feel like, you know, we've normalized sort of toxicity in our culture for so long. And, you know, the past couple of years has provided a space for recognizing that we don't want to go back to normal in any way, shape, or form, because that wasn't working.
And Jennifer, finally, I'll come to you. What's your perspective like on, well, I suppose, the new normal that we are now living in, as somebody whose books have sort of, you know, looked forwards and backwards?
Well, one very small thing I've learned, but it's actually been kind of life-changing, is that there are a lot of really amazing birds in Brooklyn, New York. So that's one thing. I spent the winter like in our little backyard wrapped in electric blankets watching those birds. I think the thing that I've learned is that human beings are really adaptable, very resilient, and very resourceful. More than I think I was giving us credit for, and able to work collectively, as Sequoia is saying. That's all really heartening, because I live in a state of constant dread about environmental collapse. And I feel like seeing that collective resourcefulness is heartening, because it makes me think, actually, we have the ability to solve this. Now, the will is another question. But I guess the last thing I would say is that I remind myself a lot, you know, we are all keenly aware of the uniqueness of this moment. And of course, every moment is unique. It's never been now until now. But I think it's one thing that reading reminds me of, and certainly reading work from past eras, is that humans have lived in a state of existential dread and real threat for an enormous amount of human history, and an enormous number of human beings have felt that way legitimately. So I think it's important to remember that, you know, unique as we are, and this moment is, we, you know, humans have found a way through a lot of them. And I want to see us, and I pray that we will use these tools of your source of resourcefulness and adaptability and collective effort to actually fix the problem of environmental peril.
A fitting note to end on there, Jennifer. Thank you. As I mentioned earlier, we'll hear Ali Smith talking about some of the things that she's learned through writing her seasonal quartet and that occupy her final book in that section, companion piece. But it leaves time for me just to say thank you to all three of you for your books. I'm going to hold them up now, although these are proof copies for those who are watching, not the finished copies, which are gorgeous. Our How We Go in the Dark by Sequoia Nagamatsu is out now. Our Country Friends by Gary Steingart is also out now. And The Candy House by Jennifer Egan will be out very, very soon, and has a particularly gorgeous Waterstone special edition, I have to say, having seen it. So thank you so much, all three of you, for your books. Thank you for speaking to me about them today. And thank you for your time.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's always respond to the world with our doors and windows open. Let's always, when there's a wall, put a window in it and go through that window and invite people in through that window and that door that we'll make in it. At this time, when things are so in the air and when we have all been so troubled by solitude and questions of hospitality, and in a time when our own country is wrestling madly with the notion of who's allowed in and who isn't allowed in, as millions and millions of people are moving across the surface of this world, let us respond to the world knowing that we all live in it equally.